choice with Paige Nick on FMR.
Hello and welcome to Book Choice on Fine Music Radio. My name is Paige Nick and I'm the host of this lovely show where we manage to talk about books for a full hour. We have a host of wonderful reviews and even more wonderful interviews for today's show, so I hope you'll stick around. I'm going to very quickly give you a little taste of what we've got coming up and then we're going to head straight into the show because we've got so much content and never enough time for the books. So we found ourselves right at the end of September, the very last day of September today. Tomorrow we head into October and the end of the year is just going to roll on. I know it's going to come so fast. So maybe you're starting to think about what you want to put on your to-read pile for summer. And also maybe about your gift list for the gifting, the big old gifting season. So we've tried to build a show here today that's got a little bit of something for everyone. Mainstream fiction. We've got genre fiction, we've got non-fiction, we've got memoir, we've got something about animals, we've got something about the Cedarburg. I hope you've got a pen handy so you can have a listen and if anything strikes you, make a note. We also load this show as a podcast at the end of the show. So if you miss anything, you can just go onto fmr.co.za and you can download it. So here's a little overview to whet your appetite. This is kind of an amuse-bouche of the show. Riley Herbert Henry is a relatively new reviewer on the show, and he's joining us to chat about a very critically acclaimed book called Saraswati, which is by Gurneek Johar. After that, Beryl Eichenberger joins us with a nice big fat juicy novel called The Listeners by Maggie Stiefvater. Then Shirley Gula is here with a South African title. Yay! We're always very excited to host a South African title. This one is Pillow Talk. It's by Nivashni Nair Sukhdev. After that, our young adult reviewer, Rachel van der Pfeiffer, is here chatting about a title called Ladies' Night, which is by two authors, Amy Kaufman and Megan Spooner. Then we go into some nonfiction. Mark Falconer is a guest reviewer who sometimes joins us on the show. He's chatting about the new memoir by Marcus Zusak. It's called Three Wild Dogs. You may recognize the name Marcus Zusak, and it might be on the tip of your tongue. We'll tell you who he is a little bit down the line. And then Twangi Kalula wraps up all our reviews with a review of The Shadow State, which is by Jeff Wicks. Twangi always covers our business and political books. And then, very exciting, we have two big reviews. Philip Todras chats to Michael Godby about a book called Object Lessons, Still Life Paintings by Irma Stern from 1908 to 1965, which is by Michael Godby, so he's in the studio to talk about it. And then our wonderful Beverly Ruiz Miller chats to Peter Slingsby about a book called Cedarburg. Now, this book has traveled quite a journey to get to us, and we're very happy that Bev has joined us in the studio to delve a little bit deeper into the story behind the story, which is quite fascinating, but also a real journey. So let's dive straight into the show, starting with Riley Herbert Henry, who is chatting about Saraswati by Gurneek Johar.
When a long-lost river rises from the dust of Punjab, seven lives scattered across the globe begin to flow back toward a shared past. Saraswati is a dazzling, polyphonic epic about myth, memory, and the future of a fractured world. In this modern novel of circumstance, the core premise is rooted in both ancient mythology and modern geopolitics. Seven distant relatives separated by geography and culture are traced through time, their stories forming a multi-stranded narrative that begins with Sejal and Jugard, an intercaste couple whose descendants would eventually traverse the globe. We meet Satnam, who returns to Punjab for his grandmother's funeral, when astonishing discovery is made. The long dry well behind the farmhouse is now full of water. Could this mark the return of the mythical Saraswati River? The narrative follows seven relatives, who include a Canadian eco-saboteur and musician, a Kenyan archaeologist, a Mauritian entomologist obsessed with yellow crazy ants, a Bollywood stunt double, a Pakistani teen who runs a fan account for an Indian singer, and an Indian journalist. Their stories trace back to the Kis, Punjabi folk tales that recount their family's origin story, and the enduring love of Sejal and Jugard. Johar writes with intensity and vigour. His prose is lyrical and complex. He invites the reader to think beyond the page, engaging deeply with themes such as the climate crisis, nationalism and ideology, diasporic identity, and the lingering legacy of colonialism. He also explores the tension between spiritual yearning and political opportunism. Although this is his debut novel, it feels as though we are in the hands of a seasoned storyteller. The characters are rich and well-drawn, the plot is sprawling yet precise, and the structure is ambitious but elegantly executed. Sarasvati is ideal for readers who enjoy novels that experiment with form and narrative scope. The novel echoes the ambition of Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell, and the layered lyricism of Arundhati Roy's The Ministry of Utmost Happiness. Johal has also been compared to the polyphonic storytelling of Zadie Smith and the satirical sharpness of Salman Rushdie. In Sarasvati, Gunnar Johal weaves a magisterial, immersive narrative that blends folkloric resonance, global-scale environmental intrigue, and the legacies of colonialism and nationalism. The result is a powerful and timely debut that asks us to reckon with the past, question the myths we inherit, and consider what kind of future we're building before the waters rise again. Sarasvati is written by Gunnar Johal, published by Serpent's Tale, and distributed in South Africa by Jonathan Ball Publishers.
Thank you, Riley. I heard you say the word powerful there about this book, and I have to agree, everything I've heard about this book has led to the same conclusion. People are saying this is an incredibly powerful novel. So I think this is a good one for a summer reading list. And now we turn to Beryl Eichenberger, who's going to be telling us about another possibility for your big summer reading list. This is The Listeners by Maggie Stiefvater by Beryl Eichenberger.
I had left The Listeners by Maggie Stiefvater to stew, so to speak, thinking it would be a light, frothy read to be read in between the tense thrillers. But oh, how wrong I was. Definitely neither of those assumptions. In fact, it brought a little-known, well, to me anyway, piece of wartime history to luminous light in a wonderfully constructed story. This is Stiefvater's first novel for adults, and as an artist in several mediums and a musician, her prose reflects how she sees her environment and what lies underneath. The cover of the book says it all, intricate, mystical, to be carefully looked into. Her research took her 5 years. She uncovered many stories, revealing heartbreak, choices, and the chilling reality of the Nazi regime's doctrines and what return might mean. You might then ask, what does a remote luxury hotel in the Appalachian Mountains in West Virginia have to do with World War II? Well, it's 1942, after Pearl Harbor. The USA has joined the war, and so there is the question of what to do with the enemy diplomats. Removed from their posts, they had to be held before being deported back to their countries. Several luxury hotels found themselves reluctantly hosting Axis diplomatic legations. Stiefvater has created one such glamorous and regal hotel, Avalon, where high-ranking Germans, Italians, and Japanese were interned under the watchful eye of State Department agents Tucker Minnick and his team, and hosted by the female GM, June Hoss Hudson. Inherited by playboy Edgar Guilfoyle, the hotel is peopled by loyal staff, some with their own reasons to fear these guests, but showing its best hospitality face is a given. It's luxury at its best, a century of tradition as elegant as the service. That was something that rather irked me, these enemies of the state enjoying their status while atrocities were being committed in their country's names. But Stiefvater has created an undercurrent of evil, not just through the characters whose nefarious plans and every waking move is followed surreptitiously, but through the ripple, drip, splash and torrent of the sweet waters that run under the hotel and down the mountain. Listening, healing when it wants to be, turning when not. It's a deliciously clever characterization. The water is something June knows plenty about. A mountain girl brought up alongside the Guilfoyle family, the children her playmates, the father educating her to take over as GM. It's an interwoven story. She listens to the water as she listens to her guests and her heart. Then there's the snails, both as a glass gift and crunching underfoot in strange places. There are chilling moments which dig deep as the listening reveals plots, desperation, and sadness. Stiefvater creates listeners throughout, through the walls with Agent Minnick, in the halls with innuendo, in code with the nameless guest in 411, the injured family member. Listening becomes tangible. She surprises her readers, keeps you guessing. Her characters are multi-layered and she adds some surprising twists, all underpinned with a sort of magic that reminded me of Alice Hoffman novels, but Stiefvater has her own distinctive, addictive style. That many of the bizarre circumstances were taken from records is extraordinary, but desperate times call for desperate measures. And as Stiefvater notes, as a novelist, I usually have to dramatize reality. In The Listeners, I find myself having to do the opposite. A novelist's dream and a reader's delight. The Listeners by Maggie Stiefvater is published by Headline.
You'll be swell. You'll be great. Gonna have the whole world on a plate. Starting here, starting now. Honey, everything's coming up roses. Clear the decks. Clear the tracks. You've got nothing to do but relax. Blow a kiss, take a bow. Honey, everything's coming up roses. Now's your inning. Stand the world on its ear. Set it spinning. That'll be just the beginning. Curtain up, light the lights. You've got nothing to hit. Well, you'll be great. I can tell. Just you wait. That lucky star I talk about is you. Honey, everything's coming up roses for me and for you. You can do it. All you need is a hand. Can do it. Mama is gonna see to it. Curtain up, light the lights. We got nothing to hit but the heights. I can tell, wait and see. There's the bell, follow me. And nothing's gonna stop us till we're through. Sunshine and Santa Claus. Everything's gonna be bright lights and lollipops. Everything's coming up roses for me and for you.
That was Everything's Coming Up Roses by Julie Harris, and that first segment with Riley and Beryl really got us into the booky mood, and we're heading straight into the rest of our show now, our second segment of the show. You're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your bookie host, Paige Nick. Our show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. I've got Mzu Makeda here with me, and Mzu curates all the beautiful music that we listen to on the show, and he also pulls the whole show together. So thank you to you too, Mzu. We really appreciate everything that you do. Okay, so we've got Shirley Gula is up next, and she has a very interesting book to share with us. It's called Pillow Talk, and it's by Nivashni Nair Sukhdev. So Nivashni is a former award-winning journalist for the Sunday Times. She's also the author of What's on My Mind, Making Babies, a memoir about her triumph over infertility. She ventured into romance fiction with her debut, which was in February 2022, and she's since written four romance novels. So she's on a bit of a roll, and this is her latest. It's called Pillow Talk.
A de-stressor, if ever there was one. Pillow Talk by Nivashni Nair Sukhdev is just what you need to upscale your mood, and mine needed upscaling. It's sweet and charming, and although sometimes a little pat, the unfolding, even secret romance of Shona and Sen has you rooting for the obvious to come out. The title alludes to the initial arrangement, just sex, no pillow talk. An arrangement with no strings. From an effective start, where the hair of angelic-looking Shona, beautifully described as chaos, cascaded over the pillow, Pillow Talk expands into feathery fun for the cast finding themselves or their true feelings. Of course, from start to happy ending, there are lots of broken telephone links, lots of picking up stompies and lots of misunderstandings. In fact, there's everything but the kitchen sink when it comes to jumping to conclusions. As in true romance stories, there are tiffs and tears and sulks and making up. The book is not only about love or friendship with definite benefits. There are family issues that affect everyone, from the seemingly vapid mother whose life was put on hold when her brother-in-law died, and the witch bitch of a grandmother who made demands on her other son. There is a son himself, father of Shona, and a shell of his former self, who makes his two daughters work in the business being a tailor shop, or so they think. There's a social butterfly sister, Aruna, who eventually has a heart-to-heart with Shona. In fact, they all do. And suddenly understanding dawns. So the family dynamics and dashed dreams and expectations managed by the shrew of a grandmother, even from the grave, continues to send daggers through those dreams. Shona and Sam aren't babies, so perhaps they should be a little more mature about their emotions. Shona has a side hustle of designing bridal veils with dreams as big as the Durban sky. Thank heavens, they are realized. Sin is a lawyer from a little town with roots that go deep, both his and the town's, and behind them both, Shona's family's tailoring business is smoldering, taking up space in Shona's head even as she walks away. Sanity prevails in the subterfuge in Sin's friend Sam and Shona's friend Annie, who miss the subtleties of the blooming romance, which is spiced by comments like, "We'll make space when both of you have significant others in their lives." Sin's own grandfather has the most sense of all and knows long before Sin does how the story will end. The only thing that is clear is that all are trapped in webs, and the unraveling of this local love story makes it fun to follow. It all comes together as one would expect in this light and easy to read romance.
Lock up your men and your dragons, because it's ladies' night. And yes, that's night with a K, because this is Amy Kaufman and Megan Spooner's hilarious new medieval fantasy. Gather round, all you gentle thems and gentle ladies. It's time for the annual Tournament of the Dragon Slayers, where only the best and the bravest of the kingdom's knights will fight for glory and the hand of the county's most eligible maiden, Lady Isabel. And this year, the talk of the castle is a mysterious new entrant, Sir Gawain. Is it just me, or does he bear suspicious resemblance to the blacksmith's daughter? Ladies' Night is one of my favorite books I've read this year. I loved everything about it, from the characters, including a lady's maid who may or may not be an assassin, to clever jokes using modern references like vendors selling tournament shirts that the buyers quickly shorten to, well, t-shirts. There are also infrequent chapters from the perspective of the mysterious narrator who offers amusing fourth wall breaks and commentary on the story as it goes along. Although sapphic medieval fantasy may sound like a pretty niche genre, I read a couple of similar books in the past, but Ladies' Night definitely tops the list. It manages to successfully balance a light-hearted tone while still offering excellent social commentary, an essential when writing a book about a woman infiltrating what is probably the ultimate medieval boys' club, a tournament of knights all attempting to knock each other off their horses. Ladies' Night is written by Megan Spooner and Amy Kaufman and is published by HarperCollins.
We went straight from Shirley Guler chatting about Pillow Talk into Rachel van der Pfeffer telling us about the latest young adult title, that she's read. Rachel was chatting there about Ladies' Night by Amy Kaufman and Megan Spooner. So you've got two really diverse options there. Certainly if one doesn't appeal to you, if Pillow Talk didn't appeal to you, maybe Ladies' Night appealed to you, or maybe it appeals to somebody in your circle. Maybe there's a young adult in your life who you think might enjoy it. You need to buy a birthday present and who knows what to buy. That might be a really good one. We've got a track now. This is Blue Fountain by the Soweto String Quartet.
Thank you.
Welcome back. That was Blue Fountain by the Soweto String Quartet, and you are tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. On this fine Tuesday at lunchtime, we are talking about one of my very favorite subjects. So now we have a bit of nonfiction to chat about, and every now and then Mark Falconer joins us on the show when something appeals to him. Mark Falconer is a phenomenal educationer. He's a teacher, he's been a principal, and so much more. And this book caught his fancy. It's called Three Wild Dogs. It's by Marcus Zusak. So if that name rings a bell, if you're in the bookie world, it's likely to ring a bell. Marcus Zusak is an Australian-German writer. He has had two massive bestsellers, and those are the ones he's best known for. The one was called The Book Thief. Do you remember that? I love that book. The second one was called The Messenger. They became smash hit international bestsellers. He's won a number of awards for those books, and now he's brought out Wild Dogs. Welcome to the show, Mark Falconer, to tell us about Marcus Zusak's memoir, Three Wild Dogs.
Hello, Paige, and hello, listeners. I have the great pleasure of doing the review of Three Wild Dogs and the Truth, a memoir by Marcus Zusak, author of The Book Thief. My name is Mark Falconer, and I feel particularly well-positioned to do a review on a book about dogs, since I'm eventually in the position to get a new little puppy, which at the moment has not even yet been born, so long as the waiting list. But this book is about three dogs, so that's no surprise. I must be honest, though, I'm not quite sure exactly what the criterion used was for the selection of these animals, but on the face of it, this family seems to have a bizarre way of choosing their pets. The most difficult, the most troubled, and the most hectic dogs seem to have been on this family's first choice list. I'm not sure why this is, but perhaps it's part of the theme of redemption and saving, which comes up several times in the text. Reuben, part wolf, Archer, beautiful but maniacal, and Frosty, who does not feature too much but does not seem to be quite in the same league as the other two dogs. On the face of it, the book is about owning and loving pets, about the energy and the challenges and the expense, the frustrations, the embarrassment that these animals, these particular animals, cause, and the required courage to love a creature no one else is willing to. But actually, it is all about family, and most of all, it is about love. Flawed, human, and imperfectly perfect. It is also, throughout, about the visceral truth of mortality and loss. Marcus Zusak is perhaps best known for The Book Thief, and in truth, this book, however honest, intimate, endearing, evocative, and thought-provoking, and it is certainly all of those things, it is not going to topple The Book Thief from the podium as his finer work. Certainly, though, if one looks for common themes, they are there aplenty. The imperative of a writer's need to articulate and to own his experience. The theme of making sense of the complexity and the sometimes conflicted relationship, but in this case, the Zusak family with their wild dogs. It would be too precious to see this book as an extended analogy of one's dealings with life and love, but even so, there are some parallels. Through it all, as with the sublime Book Thief, there are explorations of mortality, of relationships, and what it means to be a good person and a good animal, if there are degrees of goodness and badness in animals. And there is humor, the case of the suspected eating of a whole month's worth of prescription anti-inflammatories, which reminds me of a similar story I heard while working at a school of a dog that ate a month's supply of Ritalin. This was to explain that the child had underachieved in their exams, but it did conjure up such hilarious images of extremely focused walks and undistracted squirrel chasing. Three Wild Dogs is also about loss and grief and hope and salvation, about what it means to belong, about identity and family. One often hears about the pure love of a dog for their human or humans, who, however, are very seldom able to maintain that kind of purity in any relationship, even with their dogs, especially, for example, the problematic Wolf Reuben, who among so many other wild stories contrives to attack the Zusak children's piano teacher. The course of true love never did run smooth. It's a wonderful book and highly recommended. Marcus Zusak, The Three Wild Dogs and The Truth, a memoir, published by Pan Macmillan in 2025.
Thank you so much, Mark Falconer. We join now on the show. Twangi Kalula is going to bring us our final review for today's show before we head into our interview section. And Twanji's talking about quite an interesting book. This is our second South African title on today's show. And this one's called The Shadow State, and it's by Jeff Wicks. So this book, The Shadow State, traces the shocking murder of a whistleblower, Babita Deokran, a Gauteng health official who was gunned down in August 2021. While the hitmen were caught, the masterminds behind her assassination remain in the shadows. So this was Wicks's investigation, which exposed the dark networks of state capture, and it's a gripping expose from everything I've heard. And of course, Twanji Kulula loves to dig his teeth into these kinds of stories, so we invited Twanji into the show to tell us a little bit more about The Shadow State by Jeff Wicks.
I often think about corruption in South Africa like I think about the rugby. It feels like a national pastime, it brings us together at Braai's, and we all have a lot to say from the sidelines. But when it comes down to it, very few of us have the willingness or aptitude to grab the ball and fight the good fight. When Babita Deokran, a single mother and chief accountant at the Gauteng Department of Health, took steps to put an end to billions of rand of tender fraud, she paid the ultimate price and was assassinated outside her home. Seasoned investigative journalist Jeff Wicks picked up the story and was determined to shed light on the dark web of criminality so that Babita's courage wouldn't be in vain. Thank you for joining us, Jeff.
No, thank you so much for having me.
So weeks after Babita's death, you kind of approached her family and the story kind of stuck with you, and you made a commitment to them that you would see it to the end and kind of shed light on all of it. What really resonated with you with this particular story?
I think we all understand the recent history of the state capture epoch, and I think there should be an awareness that state capture has not ended, but in fact morphed in our country. I mean, I'm an investigative journalist, so we don't really get involved in the day-to-day crime stories, which are so prevalent as well. But by dint of Babita's position at the Gauteng Health Department as chief accountant, she would know where the bodies are buried in the ledgers. And then the manner in which she was killed was so brutal and had so much intent behind it that it was obvious then that it was a hit, and it was a hit intended to send a message. And I think, like any good journalist, you push forward trying to understand the why behind anything. And that was the question we sought to answer first with our investigation through News 24 and then in the book, is trying to understand exactly why an innocent woman had to die. And she had to die at the hands of nefarious networks of extraction that have stolen billions upon billions of rands from a public hospital. And that's the real tragedy of Babita Deokran's tale.
I mean, it's ultimately a sad, tragic story, but the way you've told it is incredibly riveting. And there were many ways you could have told the story, but I was fascinated that you chose a first-person narrative. Why did you decide to go that route?
I think in as much as it was Babita's story, you know, we picked up on what was her final investigation. And she was able to get to a certain point before she was assassinated and murdered. And the challenge for us was then to then take up those cudgels and say, well, we're going to continue this work as far as we can, because we didn't want Babita Deokran to have died in vain, or certainly I didn't want that to be the status quo. So it was an immense challenge from a personal perspective, not only to pursue the story, but to take on the threat and risk that Babita had taken on herself. And of course, there were times where it was scary and the danger was very real. And you have to ask yourself at some point as a journalist, is this a story worth dying for? And often the answer is no, but in this case it is yes, because this is way bigger than any one person. You know, there are millions of people who depend on the public healthcare network in Gauteng and nationally. And that money was being diverted from an impoverished and perennially understaffed and under-resourced hospital. The cost could be measured in lives. Mm. We don't know what that cost is. We know that Babita paid the ultimate price. There will be other deaths linked to this extraction. Mm. And when she filed her report into these suspicious transactions and called for an investigation and froze funds, she was murdered. There was no investigation and funds were released. Mm. So when we realized that her report had been covered up, we then had a duty to take her story forward and to prevent these pernicious networks of extraction from operating further, because we were the only ones that knew about it at that point.
Mm. I mean, I often interview journalists on this particular show or review books by them, and I think the common theme is that newspapers are struggling. It's a selfless career. And I think the one thing you do really great in the book is lay out how much work goes into an investigation of this scale. Can you just give us a slight overview of the amount of effort you had to put in to get to the end of this book?
Certainly. We were able to break the story open because we had a data set, and it was not a small data set. We had a forensic image of Babita Deokaran's phone, and we confined ourselves to the last month of her life. That was 16,000 lines of data on an Excel spreadsheet. Then we had the contents of her laptop. That was 60,000 emails and various hundreds upon hundreds of documents and ledgers, which we had to try and make sense of. So, and that's what few people understand about investigative journalism, is that you see the headlines and you see the outcomes. But in reality, this has been a four-year project. That is the time investment there. And then before we even committed a single word to a page in the first story that we broke, I was off diary for months, just reading and plotting and trying to understand exactly what she'd found and following the money. And it's a slow pursuit and it's often thankless, but the reality is it remains important. And I was thinking about the same thing this morning. We have such a small cohort of investigative journalists in South Africa because of the shrinking media climate. And oftentimes, the ink of investigative journalists is the thin black line between total capture. Mm. And not to say that journalists are the be-all and end-all. They are good South Africans all over the place. But the Fourth Estate has an immense responsibility and role to play in trying to pull this country back from the mafia state backslide.
And I ended up leaving kind of this book feeling like it was just the tip of the iceberg, that there were many Babita Deokaran's out there. What are you hoping that ordinary South Africans take away from the book and what their role in this kind of fight against corruption and state capture looks like?
I think Babita's story is not unique in the sense that she was a good, hardworking civil servant who had merely done the right thing and was killed for it. You know, those stories permeate our news cycle. We've seen it recently all over the place in Cape Town and in Gauteng. It's always the auditors and the liquidators and the police officers, anyone who becomes an obstacle to corruption. And in the way that her story is unique is how much information we had, and we can really paint a depraved picture of extraction. Mm. For this book, the devil is in the detail. We have been privy to aspects of the Gauteng Health Department that we never would have been able to find had we not gotten her laptop.
Yeah.
And what the book should do is it should force everyone who read it to place themselves in Babita's shoes and ask yourself the question, what would I have done in that situation? Mm. And it's an interesting confrontation to have internally, and I had to have it in writing the book, because it makes you understand the brevity of life and how quickly it can be taken away. So when South Africans read this book, and I hope that they do because it honors her memory, place yourself in her shoes. Just as you read it, look around at your family members, look around at the life that you have and the job that you have, and understand that if you were placed in that position, would you still do the right thing? Would you still take the chance to stand against corruption if you looked around you and understood that everything you had could be taken away from you in an instant and you wouldn't see it coming?
Talia, I was left with that and many other questions. I think the story is informative, it's chilling, it's thought-provoking, and it reads like a thriller, even though it is the reality of our lives as South Africans. The Shadow State, Why Babita Deokaran Had to Die by Jeff Wicks was published by Tafelberg and retails for 370 Rand.
A pretty lady looked at me.
That was Does Anyone Really Know What Time It Is by Track 5, and I'm telling you, I know exactly what time it is. It's time for Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick, and it's time that we start to wind into the second end part of our show. We have two big interviews for you today that we're going to head into now, and both of them are nonfiction. The first, Philip Todras joins us. Now, Philip generally does our kind of arts and culture books, and he chats to arts and culture kind of people. That's his happy place. And so he reached out to us and asked if he could chat to Michael Godby about Object Lessons, Still Life Paintings by Irma Stern from 1908 to 1965. So this should be a pretty interesting segment, particularly if you're interested in art, if you have a fascination with Irma Stern, which I do. So welcome to the show, Philip Todras, and thank you for inviting Michael Godby to join us and give us a little bit of insight into Object Lessons and Still Life Paintings by Irma Stern. I think this is quite a miraculous title.
I have with me Michael Godby, who has just written Object Lessons, Still Life Paintings by Irma Stern, 1908 to 1965. Michael, you're the man who's focused on Irma Stern's nude. So this new book, Still Life Painting, what specifically made you move into the genre?
Philip, yes, I had written a book on nudes and did an exhibition on nudes at the Irma Stern Museum. And Still Life is that other subject that was taught to Irma Stern, indeed every artist of the period, along with nudes. And the two genres taught aspiring artists quite strongly different things in terms of composition particularly, whereas the focus of nudes was invariably towards the center of the painting. The trainee artists turned to still life to compose across the length and breadth of the format and indeed pictorial depth. So it was a medium of instruction from her earliest times, and it's a medium that she referred to throughout her life, particularly when she wanted to experiment with other aspects of her practice, particularly color or pictorial space. So it was, as you can see from the dates, from the very beginning of her life to the very end of her life, she constantly returned to still life as a genre.
And often the compositions had what her interests were at the time, should I put it that way, and there was definitely a local African focus. Is that correct?
It's one of her projects on returning to South Africa in 1920 that she wanted to Africa. First of all, she wanted to modernize still life as it was practiced at the Cape. It was disparaged as a very Victorian, boring subject, particularly centered on flowers, and she wanted to modernize it. And in modernizing it, she also wanted to Africanize it, to tell people, particularly in Europe, that these paintings were not done in Berlin, they were done in the Cape. So she used local flowers, and she used local objects to some extent in her still life as well. But more particularly, in working at the Cape, she wanted to introduce radical new German expressionist ideas. And while much of her figure painting of this time was of idyllic African subjects that didn't really allow expressionism to any great extent, some of her still lifes were quite radical in terms of painting practice, color usage, her definition of forms, definitions of a space. So yes, she used still life very strongly in the 1920s to present herself as a modernist in conservative Cape Town.
Also, the vibrancy of the work is particularly amazing, but her choice of objects that she placed in it, a lot of them, some of those objects are still in the collection.
Indeed.
So perhaps you don't want to just talk about where she was collecting from and how she assembled these.
As you know, the Irma Stern Museum is a repository of huge amount of work, some of which was sold on at her death, of course, in the auctions. But still, there's an amazing collection of African material culture and of East Asian and European. And she started collecting clearly while she's still a student in Berlin, brought things back and included and collected throughout her life while traveling and indeed in the shops in Cape Town and Johannesburg.
You talk about traveling. Some of that is reflected in the still lives as well. Did she do some of them on site, or did she bring back some of those memories with her when she did those paintings?
The objects, she sometimes painted them overseas, not very often. Towards the end of her life, she did still lives or bowls of fruit while she was staying in hotels in Spain and the south of France. Still lives in windows, still lives with harbour scenes in the background, that sort of thing. But she didn't really paint objects overseas, as far as I know. She brought them back and she painted them at home.
Mm. And so the way you've divided up the book into different chapters, perhaps you'd just like to take us through some of those periods that you find when she was, like, refreshing herself in some ways.
Yeah, indeed.
And moving on to other areas, but those still lives were sort of setting a standard for her.
Yes. As we mentioned, some of her early still lives from the 1920s were deliberately modernist, expressionist, and Africanizing. And then around 1930, she decided that she wanted to explore color more fully. And she turned to still life again with that to explore the potential of color, even, as she said at one point, to the detriment of her subject matter. So she turned to Cézanne particularly and structured new compositions, with still life particularly, and in terms of color.
And I think we're going to have you come back again, because on the Picasso story as well, I think that's going to be a whole other review. But just in general, just end off with your words of why we have to get this book.
Oh, because like the nudes, I think it is very interesting to follow a theme from A to Z in her painting career, to see how things change and yet stay the same, and so on. Yes.
Well, she was Irma Stern. And she was the one who set the standards. But you set a very high standards in terms of object lessons, still life paintings by Irma Stern, 1908 to 1965. And this has been Michael Godby.
That was Kiss from a Rose by Tessa. And you are tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick, where we take a pause from the music to talk about books for a whole hour on this show. How cool is that? I absolutely love it, but then I could talk about books all day. So it's right up my alley. We now have our final interview of the show before I tell you a little bit about what I've been reading. And Beverly Rose Miller is here to chat to Peter Slingsby about a new book that's just come out called The Cedarberg. From everything I've heard about this book, it's been long awaited and it was hard earned. The author has been through some really big challenges to write this book. While it's already a fascinating story, it gives it even more of a fascinating story. So we thought, let's get him in the studio so he can tell us firsthand about how he did this and some of the challenges that he faced while he was doing it.
Hi, I'm Beverly Rose Muller, and today I'm speaking in the studio with Peter Slingsby, otherwise known to all of South Africa as the Map Maker. And Peter has just produced the most wonderful illustrated book on his great love, The Cedarberg, the book. And I want to talk to him about it because it is really an extraordinary achievement. Welcome, Peter.
Hi, Bev.
Please tell me how you came to write the book.
I've always wanted to write the book, but I was incapacitated for a long time, bedbound, and that gave me the opportunity to start writing.
What I find absolutely extraordinary about your writing the book, because I have known about it for some time, was that you had to lie on your back for most of this year so far, and you wrote this entire extraordinary, long, wonderful book on your phone. That's absolutely amazing. Then you laid it out with more than 600 color photographs, maps, and 82 QR codes. And it has produced this interactive, remarkable book of the entire history of the Cedarberg, the flora and fauna, the conflict. It's just the most amazing achievement. And you did it lying down. It's amazing.
Well, I guess I had to do something, and the alternative was watching reruns of television shows. So it was much more interesting than that.
Well, you've had a 70-year relationship with the Cederberg. In fact, I think that's where you met your wife, Maggie, if that is correct. And you have dedicated this book to her because she's been your partner through so much over so many years. And the entire book, from start to finish on the shelves, has been only just over 6 months. It's really quite a miracle because, as anyone who lives in the book world, you know, that just simply doesn't happen. One of the things that I really liked, Don Pinnock's introduction, I thought it was a beautiful introduction. One of the things that he says, he calls your maps and now this book cultural documents, and they really are. Could you just speak to that?
Well, I think I know what Don means. In my maps, I always try to preserve names, place names, things that told us something about the people who'd been there before. If place names are not on maps, they get lost. Rather like history, if it's not written down, people die and it's forgotten. So in a way, my thrust has been to try and preserve that cultural side, the place names that ordinary people living on the ground have for the world around them.
You introduced me to the Cederberg. Until you'd spoken to me about them, I didn't know it, the Rock Art Trail, of course. Yes. And many people won't know that there have been generations, hundreds, thousands of years of people moving through the Cederberg, the San, the Khoi, the early settlers, and conflict, of course. And the rock art there is part of the early history, but today there is a lot of other kinds of history. And you have captured the myths and the fairy tales and the truths and the lies so wonderfully with such great stories in this book. What's one of your favourites?
Oh, wow, that's a tricky question to throw at me so quickly.
Well, let me ask you, one of my favourites is most people who've been to the Achterparkes, the back of the Cederberg, know about the Englishman's grave, that lonely little grave on the side of the road. And actually, in the book...
It's a very poignant memorial, indeed.
It is, and you drive past this lonely sort of English guy who was supposedly died in the war. And yet you find out that that's actually not where he died.
No, it's a very long story. I'll try and keep it very short. The local owner of the farm was surveying for a mountain bike trail, came across a grave about 400 or 500 metres from the present grave in the veld. And it had clearly been dug and by people with the right tools and all those sort of things. And it was a modern grave. And the only explanation we can give for that grave is that that is actually where he fell. The military records are that they sent out a platoon of soldiers and buried him where he fell. Inscription on the grave says he was buried, he fell near this place, which makes us feel that the grave, as you see it, is more of a memorial erected by his elder brother than the actual grave. And the actual grave is away in the veld where you can't actually see it.
And I think it was amplified by the sort of mythology that his mother sailed out to Cape Town and every year went and put flowers on the grave. But in fact, she was dead long before the war.
She died before the war, so she can't have gone and done that.
And what's lovely about it is you go through many, many such stories and saying, these myths are true, these myths aren't true, these myths are partially true. But they're all about people and the involvement in people. Of course, the book also talks about the Cederberg, the cedars, which are actually, you say, cypresses, and the wonderful rocks. But I want to ask you a different question. What on earth made you hike the Cederberg in the early days with a cat?
Because I had a cat, and I had nobody to look after the cat. I inherited the cat from another student who dumped it on me and then disappeared. And I decided I could only keep the cat if the cat could go wherever I needed to go. So wherever I went, whether it was the Drakensberg or down the Vitels River or into the Cederberg, the cat came with me.
And Mango survived this, did he?
Mango lived to the age of about 28, long after I was married, and Maggie always reckoned she was my first love and that she was highly upset by Maggie and would never be friendly to her at all.
One of the most amazing things about the book is full of QR codes, and I was last night sitting using my phone to go through them, and it's extraordinary to read a book and then pick up the QR code and suddenly you see a leopard running through the veld on your phone, or a river tumbling. It's amazing. This is such an interactive book. It's like having a whole universe in your lap. I really don't know how you managed to do that while you were lying on your back, but it is really an amazing achievement. What is it that you think is the most important thing about the book?
Well, I think that it's telling the true story of the Cedarburg as far as I know, and I've tried to be as truthful as I can. There are too many myths, too many untrue stories, too many errors in the history. And there's never been a book about the Cedarburg before, so I felt, well, let's do it.
Well, it's beautiful, it's big, it's so exciting. I've really come across a book that has so much going for it. And I think that you finish off with the plea for conservation. This is a place that we need to love, conserve, and cherish. And this book, The Cedarburg by Peter Slingsby, certainly does that. Thank you, Peter, for being here.
Thank you, Bev.
Thank you so much, Beverly Ruiz Miller, for chatting so openly with Peter Slingsby about this remarkable new title. And that brings us to the end of our show and basically to the end of September. All that's left is that I want to tell you a little bit about what I've got going on and a little bit about what's going on in the literary calendar in South Africa and a little bit about what I'm very excited about reading. I'm going to take these last few minutes to tell you all about that. First up, I want to tell you about something that is on the literary calendar right now, and that is WordFierce. If you've never heard of WordFierce, I can tell you that it's a major arts and culture festival that takes place every year in Stellenbosch here in South Africa. It celebrates performances and stories. It celebrates music, theater, art. It especially celebrates works in Afrikaans, but increasingly they're making it accessible to non-Afrikaans speakers. So I do recommend you take a look at the program and pick out the events if you don't speak Afrikaans. There are plenty of other language events and programs that might interest you. And there are, what interests me, literary events. So lots of writers' festivities that take place and visual arts. It's really worth jumping in your car or however you want to get to Stellenbosch and going to check it out. And 2025 is marking WordFierce's 25th anniversary. So it's a real milestone and it's a really special festival. It's taking place very soon, so you don't have too long, but you've got to go and get your tickets. It's taking place from the 11th to the 19th of October this year in Stellenbosch. I recommend that you go check out wordfierce.co.za. You'll find their program and you can book tickets and get it together to go and check that out. It really is something spectacular to enjoy, and Stellenbosch is just such a marvelous, glorious place to host it. And then I want to tell you about another really big event on the literary calendar. There's a big book coming out. This is going to be a big Christmas book, a big gifting book, a big exciting book to read. And the book is called Unlocked, and it's by Eben Etzebeth. And the interesting thing here, some new news, is that it's publishing at the same time in English and in Afrikaans. So I'm going to try not to butcher the title, but the Afrikaans title is Ten Slotter. English title is Unlocked by Eben Etzebeth. So, I mean, he's got a household name, right? Whether you are into rugby or not, I'm sure you've heard his name. He is the most capped player in South African rugby history. That's a big deal if you think about how many rugby players we've had around for a really long time. He's a towering lock. His intelligence, energy, and aggression on the pitch is feared, respected, often imitated, but never matched. Look, I'm a fan. I might be biased, but I'm a big Eben Etzebeth fan, and I've just started this book, and it's kind of gripping. I never thought I would find myself reading a rugby book, but here we are. They say that Eben is the heart and soul of a historically successful Springbok team, and he's been a key part of, I want to say their astonishingly successful run, but I want to say it's our astonishingly successful run. I always feel like the whole of South Africa owns the success of South African rugby with our two consecutive World Cup wins and current two-year stint at the top of the world rankings. So this comes out at a good time, you know, while we're up on top. So I'm finding this a very frank and disarming account. It's very accessible and I'm enjoying it. Eben is where I'm at so far. He's uncovering the key factors in his extraordinary success, how he keeps focused both on and off the pitch. Also trails his humble beginnings where, you know, he started out in Goodwood and nothing's come easy to him. So he's put in a bit of a fight and he continues to fight on the rugby pitch. I'm finding it very inspiring. He's led from the front, and I like that. There are some leadership lessons to be learnt and some lessons about putting up a good fight to be learnt. And he's played against the best in the world, and he's winning. So that is 10 Slotter is the Afrikaans title, but Unlocked is the one I'm reading, and it's by Eben Etzebeth. So that's what I've got going on my bedside table right now, and that's our show. I want to thank all our reviewers, all our authors, all the publishers, and also Fine Music Radio. And I really want to thank Exclusive Books for supporting this show. We really enjoy the partnership that we have with them. And with that, we're going to play out with Downtown by Louise Howlett and Albert Combrink. And until next time, happy reading. I hope it's one of these titles. Chat soon. Bye.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown. When you've got worries, all the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know. Downtown, just listen to the music of the traffic in the city. Linger on the sidewalk where the neon signs are pretty. How can you lose? The lights are much brighter there. You can forget all your troubles, forget all your cares. So go downtown, things will be great when you're downtown. No finer place for sure, downtown. Everything's waiting for you. Downtown. Don't hang around and let your problems surround you. There are movie shows downtown. Maybe you know some little places to go to where you never close. Downtown, just listen to the rhythm of the gentle bossa nova. You'll be dancing with them soon before the night is over. Happy again. The lights are much brighter there. You can forget all your troubles, forget all your cares. So go downtown.